Welcome to the Ferris Love Podcast, where we share spiritual and practical ideas for how to live family life with a beautiful, self-sacrificing love. On today's podcast, we spoke with Dr. Jonathan Culp, Department Chair and Professor of Politics at the University of Dallas. Dr. Culp shared with us important aspects of the American political system and how to evaluate candidates when it comes to voting. Thank you, Dr. Culp, for being on our show today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So we are in the midst of election season. Next week, when this podcast is shared, we'll be voting. So this podcast is just going to be about how to choose a candidate and what kind of qualifications, and just even looking at the electoral process as well. So if you wouldn't mind sharing with us how, you know, we hear the slogans of every voice counts, you know, your vote matters. So can you explain to us how that plays a role in our American civics?
Yeah, certainly. And so, I mean, to answer this question, you have to wade into the territory of the dreaded electoral college to explain how presidents are elected, because it's a little bit more straightforward when it comes to members of the House of Representatives or to the Senate, because they're directly elected. But there's an indirect way of electing the president. So I'll explain that first, and then I can give you a few reflections on how individual votes factor in. So the president is not directly elected. You know, the presidency, it's a national office, but the president is elected through a process where the voting actually happens on a state-by-state basis. So each state under the Constitution is given a certain number of electors or electoral votes. Those are the votes that can be cast by that state towards choosing a president. So the formula for that is that each state gets a number of electoral votes that's equal to their congressional delegation, which means the total number of representatives plus senators. Every state has two senators. A state can have anywhere between one representative, like Wyoming, or I think around 50 for California, because the number of representatives that a state has depends on the population of the state. But every state gets two senators. So every state has a certain number of electoral votes, and it is the electors who actually elect the president. And the way the process works, for the most part, in most states, is that the rule in place is that, let's say you have a state that has seven electoral votes. So the major political parties in that state, always the Democrats and the Republicans, sometimes they're, you know, other parties run candidates, will choose what's called a slate of electors. So in our hypothetical state, the Democratic Party would choose seven people who are the Democratic electors, and the Republican Party would choose seven people who would be the Republican electors. And then on election day, everybody casts their votes. And the law is, whichever presidential candidate gets the most votes in the state, that party's the electors become the electors for their state. So, you know, in the state, if like Donald Trump won, then the seven Republican electors would become the official electors for that state and cast their votes. And then the requirement in the Constitution, and there are complicated sort of aspects to it, but the basic rule is you have to have a majority of electoral votes in order to be elected president. So each state casts its electoral votes. There are a total of 538 electors. So the magic number is 270. Okay. So both presidential candidates, the thing they're looking to get is 270 electoral votes. And so they'll, you know, they look and they say, okay, using their polling, what are the states where we know we're going to win? How many electoral votes does that add up to? What are the states that we might win? And they try to find that strategy where they put together, what are the states where we have a good chance of winning them? And if we win these, then we get that magic number. So that's the basic strategy that's followed. So as a voter, you know, in a literal sense, your vote doesn't count for president because you're not voting directly for president. And in the narrow sense of counting, you know, if you think like, well, my vote only counts if it directly affects the outcome. If that's the case, then nobody's vote counts because no presidential election ever comes down to one vote. The way that your vote counts is that, you know, an election is really the people of the country passing judgment on its leaders or choosing new leaders. And so your role as a voter, or the way in which your participation as a voter counts, is that you are acting as one of the people of the United States contributing to the collective process of choosing the leadership. And so even though your individual vote might not change the outcome, you can think about it like if you choose to recycle or not has no effect overall on the environment. One person's actions don't necessarily make a difference, but it does make a difference that most people act a certain way or other. So your vote counts insofar as you are acting as part of the people in making a collective decision for your country.
Great. Excellent. That's very very concise. Thank you for that, sharing that. So what kind of foundational principles of American democracy should guide voters in choosing a candidate, presidential candidate?
So that's that question, and a lot of questions when it comes to how to evaluate and choose candidates. These things are inherently controversial, not just because the candidates have different policies and things like that, because even if you're talking about something like fundamental principles of American democracy, there's a real disagreement between the candidates, between the parties, about what those principles are or what they should be. And so, it's a deep an important question. Of course, what it means is that there's probably almost no question you're going to ask where my answer won't be at least a little bit controversial, because you have to take a side on these things. There's no neutral answer to this. So, in the most basic sense, when you're thinking about the American political system, at the foundation of the American political system is the Constitution. And so, especially when you're choosing a president, this matters because the president takes an oath to uphold and protect the Constitution. So, of all the federal offices, the Constitution makes the president specially responsible for upholding the integrity of the Constitution. So, when you talk about the foundational principles of American democracy, I mean, one of the things you're going to look for in a presidential candidate is, what do they understand the Constitution to be giving them the power to do? How do they understand the constitutional office of the presidency? Now, that's a difficult thing to sort through because the American people, for many decades now, we have expectations of the office of the president that the Constitution does not actually allow the president to fulfill directly. So, when presidents campaign, usually they make lots of promises about particular policies that they're going to pursue, things they're going to do. Now, for the most part, policies are not made by presidents. That's the job of Congress. Congress makes the laws. And domestically, the primary job of the president is to enforce the laws that Congress makes. Now, of course, we all know that the president serves as a kind of leader to his or her party, and thus that the president has a role to play in setting a policy agenda. But the president doesn't have the direct power to do it. The president can't pass law. But still, it's helpful with presidential candidates, when it comes to foundational principles, like do they respect the Constitution? Do they give evidence of knowing what's in the Constitution? Do they respect rule of law? And but again, you get into controversial discussions about like, well, what does rule of law entail? So, but I would say, one of the things that you have to look for in a candidate is some kind of clear understanding that they understand that there are limits to what the president should be doing, that the president is part of a larger constitutional system that the president is not entirely in charge of, and that the president's going to have to work with Congress. Just in the same way that, to a certain extent, Congress has to work with the states. So you want to see a candidate that evinces some kind of civic knowledge. Now, here I'm answering your question since you asked about fundamental principles. I'm not talking about particular policies, but I just mean like, how do you apply it? So, does this candidate show some understanding of the Constitution, some understanding of the notion of rule of law, some understanding of the difference between being a president and being a legislator? Those are the kinds of things that I tend to look to. But now, just as a final thing on that, one thing I've learned over the years is that oftentimes, politicians are not the most knowledgeable people about the Constitution. So you have to be a little bit forgiving with that one, because we'll just say most of them are not actually experts in the document that gives them the authority that they exercise. It's sad, but true.
Yeah. I'd love to go back to what you were saying about the promises that they make, both parties make promises. How do you go about evaluating those promises, whether or not they're truthful, whether or not they're, you know, because like you said, the president a lot of the times doesn't have the power to be able to make those decisions. It works with the legislative branch and all, and you know, and the judicial branch. So how do you evaluate those promises to say, okay, actually, this person is someone I can trust to lead the country?
Yeah, that's one of those areas because obviously, politicians, they get into power by persuading people to vote for them. So they got to say a lot of things. One of the differences, though, between politics and say in business, in business, advertisements make lots of promises, but if they systematically make false promises, eventually that hits their bottom line. It's not always the case in politics that that's true because you can promise lots of stuff and half of them get forgotten and half, lost in the mix. So when it comes to assessing the basic kind of trustworthiness, I think, of politicians, one of the most reliable things you can do is look at their track record. Look what they've done so far. Because, it's easy to say stuff. You want to look back and you want to see, are there actual deeds? Are there things they've done in the past that show evidence of a commitment to a certain position? And that's not always possible. Like when Donald Trump was running in 2016, he had no political background, so he had no record in office to look at. I mean, you could look at other aspects of his life to evaluate him. But so generally speaking, I would say there are a couple things. So generally speaking, one of the things you can do is you can look at their record and see what they've actually done. That is usually a good indicator. So for example, if they promise to do a certain thing, but you see in their record that they've repeatedly done the opposite, then it's probably not likely that they mean that promise. Another thing, and now this requires more civic knowledge of the voter, is to test that promise, as I was mentioning before, test the promise against what the actual powers of the office are. Because this person promising something they can't even do. Because in that case, that doesn't necessarily mean the promise is insincere. It could just be that they're not fully aware of the limits of their own authority. But, still, I mean, if they're promising to do a whole bunch of different stuff that's not clearly something they'll be authorized to do, you at least should sort of downgrade the extent to which you should expect them to keep that promise. They might not be able
Great. So I know it's kind of, it's kind of a loaded question because you hear people make promises all the time and it sounds really good, and if there people have that rhetoric and the ability to convince, and it can be a bit challenging.
It is.
But yeah. So last week we had talked about kind of Catholic social teaching and all that stuff, and one of the things that we did mention was the common good. You know, like being able to discern that, you know, a candidate should be able to encourage and increase the common good. So how this might be one of those other loaded questions where it's like, oh, it could be all kinds of things, but how can a voter know that that person is going to assist in the common good, you know, and how can they evaluate that too?
So that's, the common good is, you're never going to have a non-controversial understanding of what the common good requires. I mean, I tend to think that, the first thing you got to do with a candidate is, evaluate their speeches, their records, to see if you can get a kind of vision of what their top priorities are. I mean, I think in a certain way, if you see what the top priorities are for a candidate, you can, that's kind of like seeing their vision of the common good. Like, these are the most important priorities for the country that, I think I should be pursuing. So the first thing you do is you try to see, okay, well, what is the vision you get from that, from a candidate? And then you have to go into the discernment process and ask yourself whether you think that that's actually consistent with the common good. Like, are these things actually good for the country? Are they the wrong priorities? Are they in the wrong order? Are there things left out? Are some of these priorities, to use the language of the Catholic social teaching, are some of these priorities actually intrinsically evil? Which is unfortunately something that we do have to face because, at least in the case of the Democratic Party, there is a very strong commitment to expanding access to abortion, and that's not just like a secondary position. That's one of the central things that they've been campaigning on this year, and that, of course, is an intrinsically evil act. So you've got to factor all that in. That doesn't mean that by itself should determine your vote. I'm assuming in the previous episode he might have talked a little bit about the contingencies that a voter can face when evaluating that kind of stuff. So the commitment to the common good that a candidate has, it begins by evaluating whether they have a vision of the common good that you think that they should be committed to. And if they pass muster somewhat, then you still have that question again of things like looking at their record or looking at their proposal. So there are a couple things here. One of which is like, have they demonstrated in their actions and things that might actually cost them something, as opposed to in just their deeds, that they are committed to these things? So is there sort of demonstrated commitment? Another, a little bit more indirect way of doing it, but that's also helpful, is to, they'll say big things like, I'm for growing the economy, but then look at the policies that they're actually promoting and ask yourself, do these policies actually line up with what they say they're promoting? Because sometimes you can be for a good end, like everybody wants people to have jobs, but your policy for promoting it could actually be an extremely stupid one, or a counterproductive one. So you look at their record, you look at the means that they're proposing to those ends, and before all of that, I would say you have to evaluate the ends that they've committed themselves to.
Okay. Those are great points. What I'm curious your thoughts on, so this will be the second election I vote in, actually. But just as I've grown up and have been more interested in politics and just kind of even looking into policies, what are your thoughts on like international relations and, how we should discern if a candidate is someone who's, for America or not for America, depending upon those? Do you think that is a like a high would you rate someone's pro-Americanism, I guess, based on their how they would, view their international relations?
Yeah, that's one that varies, in part because the extent to which foreign relations matters can vary. There are times when, like after September 11th, for example, where foreign policy sort of dominated politics. Like that was sort of the number one thing, and obviously during, like Vietnam era, there was a time. So there are times when issues of foreign policy just jump to the top of the list. And when they do, then those are the times when I would say, especially with the president, you have to weigh that heavily, because, from the very beginning, even though many aspects of the American political system have changed in a lot of ways since the founding, from the very beginning, the Constitution very deliberately puts the president in the driver's seat of American foreign policy. So obviously, it's Congress is the one that organizes and funds the military. Only Congress has the right to declare war. So Congress has a role to play, but the president is the commander in chief of the armed forces. So he's at the top of the chain of military command. The president appoints all U.S. ambassadors. They have to be approved by the Senate, but it's the president who picks, our ambassadorial, representatives in the rest of the world. He chooses the Secretary of State, who is the one basically in charge of the U.S. diplomatic service. And the president negotiates treaties. Now, for a treaty to go into effect, it has to be ratified by the Senate. But still, that means in all of these things that oftentimes the president is the one that has the power of initiative in these areas. And by virtue of having the power of initiative, by virtue of having kind of access to foreign leaders and being up there doing that, the president has a lot more scope for setting foreign policy in some ways, even than domestic policy. So because foreign policy is sort of specially entrusted in many ways to the president, international affairs are something that you definitely need to factor in, especially when they're a high priority. But even when they're a low priority, because, as we all know, with the way things work in international politics, things happen, right? And all of a sudden, like when Bush and Gore were campaigning against each other in 2000, that the their debates, the campaign, it was almost entirely about domestic policy. It was a time of relative peace and stability. Bush did not run, and most people did not vote for Bush on the basis of him being a great foreign policy president. But then September 11th happens and things change. So even when you think that domestic matters are going to be, you're going to have the priority, it's still the case that you need to think about a president's sort of international vision when voting, because that it could become more relevant than you think it's going to be. Now, how you assess, sort of the pro-Americanness of a president in this regard, I mean, that's either an unanswerable question or probably would require like more time than we have on this podcast. But I mean, obviously you want to look for a president that somehow dem or a presidential candidate, and the way I would put it is that demonstrates discernment. And what I mean by that is that when they are asked questions about foreign policy, that you can see that there's a thought process there where they understand the costs and the benefits of different courses of action. Because, it's very easy to just make some kind of blanket statement about what we should do. But especially in foreign policy, the US has a gigantic military. Its presence is all over the place. It is very, we're not omnipotent at all, but we're a very influential country. And so the president of the United States has, more than almost any other individual in the world, the power to affect the kind of international climate. So you want to see some evidence that you have a president who's capable of being thoughtful about strategy.
Yeah, that kind of goes back to, I mean, I'm sure it goes back to, historically, like president, like the Civil War, all that era and all that, just having to even work through those kinds of things. So what we're experiencing now is kind of this insane, I would say, like knowledge of all things because of social media, because of the news, because you see everything and you hear everything, whether positive or negative. You just have that scope now that maybe you didn't have back in the 2000s or in the earlier. And most people watch the news, so how do you take what you see from the news and evaluate it to a point where you trust it, or you don't, or you take into account what they're saying and then make an informed decision based on those things?
Yeah, though that's right. I mean, most people rely on the media for, the information that they have. And, one of the effects of the last, 15 years or so with the rise of social media is it's kind of funny, like everybody sort of, despite themselves, has had to become a little bit of a media critic, because we're just much more aware of the fact that almost everything that we encounter is coming at us from an angle. And so you've got to, you're very aware of that fact. Now, media bias, this is one of those things that, in the same way that two wrongs don't make a right, two biased media sources don't make the truth. So you can't just say like, well, I'll just read a, right-wing site and a left-wing site, and then somehow, like it'll average out to the truth. It doesn't work that way, in part because, on social media, but also a lot of media organizations, it's almost where their primary business is one of presenting narratives, and then they present facts when they are facts, arranged in a way that fit with that narrative. So it's not like you have these free-floating neutral facts that you can strip the narrative away from and get to and then add together. So when you're dealing with competing narratives, it can be extremely difficult to figure out how to weigh and assess the evidence that they're offering. So, I mean, a few bits of advice that I have there is that, and this is not, this takes time to act on, but the more fundamental knowledge, which I've been, I think, kind of hinting at, is that deeper knowledge of the kind of historical and constitutional knowledge of our system. So because it's you have to get to more kind of expert sources, but it is possible to get a reliable understanding of how the Constitution works, the history of certain constitutional provisions. And so I would say strengthening your foundation and understanding the basic principles of the American system and how they've developed over time, because that gives you knowledge that you can use to assess the different media sources. So you can look at it and, I mean, this is happening, obviously, I make my living partly by teaching the Constitution. And so, it happens to me all the time where I'll read an article and you see it, and it's like, this person actually does not understand how the Constitution works. So at that point, you can kind of discount their commentary because you recognize they're not actually well informed. So at least one thing you can do is by getting, and the other thing that's nice about that is, of course, that kind of that historical knowledge and political knowledge, it's more possible to find, kind of a consensus on those things because it's in the past or it's more abstract. So it's a little bit more dispassionate. People who have different political commitments can actually agree on things there because they're not in the immediate fight. So it gives you a little bit of that distance you need to understand the character of the system, and you can bring that with you to evaluate the sources that you read. I mean, we're inherently biased, and there's no way around that. It's going to affect our media decisions. But so that's why I would say. And also, there are things like the Catholic News Agency. I mean, if you're Catholic, I do think there are some good sources out there where you can at least, if you have to choose among competing narratives, you can at least kind of, find the narrative that's maybe closer to the truth in a lot of things. Although, again, you have that range of opinion still within Catholic news sources. And I mean, I certainly wouldn't recommend any news source where the editorial line is clearly in dissent with fundamental teachings of the church. But Catholic news sources that are faithful can be one way of, getting a perspective that can be more trustworthy. But beyond that, it's really more kind of background knowledge. Just bring, have that background civic knowledge and then bring that to the media sources.
Other than, the Constitution itself and the Bill of Rights and all that, how what would you recommend people could read to help? And those news sources you were saying for more to find more truth in what they're saying. But let's say someone wants to be able to inform themselves better about the Constitution, what could they look up or other than the Constitution itself?
Well, because the Constitution is, I mean, I don't like curl up at night in front of the fire reading the Constitution with like a mug of hot chocolate or something. It's not a fun document to read. It's just an instruction manual for a government. So the only way to make the Constitution really meaningful and to have it come alive is to kind of understand the thought process, the accumulated human experience and wisdom that's embodied in the different provisions. And so to do that, I mean, the most immediate, although it can be difficult to read, the most immediate source of greater knowledge in that would be the Federalist Papers, written primarily by James Madison and Alexander Hamilton. The Federalist Papers were a series of editorials written under the pen name Publius. And it was projected by Alexander Hamilton. It was during the time when the Constitution had been proposed and was sent to the states for ratification. So this was the Constitution hadn't yet been adopted, and this and in each of the states there was a debate about whether to adopt it. And so the Federalist Papers were written to explain and defend the Constitution in order to persuade people to ratify it. Hamilton and Madison were both at the Constitutional Convention, so they had kind of inside knowledge of the deliberations. They were both very experienced. Hamilton, had been Washington's right-hand man during part of the Revolutionary War. Madison had been a member of the Virginia legislature. So, these were experienced, historically informed, politically experienced, serious people with direct knowledge of the drafting of the document. It's 18th century English. My experience was that students kind of, to them, it's sort of like reading Shakespeare. It's like, yes, this is English, I think. And also, again, it presupposes a certain amount of historical knowledge. So you should find an edition of the Federalist Papers that has footnotes so that you can, like, what's the Delian League, right? And things like that. You need to be able to look that up. But so I would say start with something like the Federalist Papers. A lot of times there, a good edition of the Federalist Papers will have a good bibliography of other things you can read. So I would really start. I mean, that's high stuff, but These things were originally newspaper editorials. Farmers debated them. I mean, we can do this, people. We can read this book and understand the Constitution. So I would say start there.
Awesome. That's great. What would you say to someone who's like not interested in voting this, like who just sees both parties as not a fan and they think that the best thing they should do is not to vote?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sympathetic with that position. Because, well, I mean, the fact of the matter is that politics, in a good world, the politics is not going to be where you look for meaning. I mean, politics is, a lot of times, if politics is exciting, that's because something's gone wrong. Ideally, the government is something that should be kind of in the background, securing the peace and order and prosperity that you need for people to live fruitful lives in their own communities, right? In their families and their neighborhoods and their churches and private associations and schools. And, government's there to enable that. But that stuff is where real life is. And so when people are not excited about politics, I perfectly understand that. I mean, I did not, and practically until the day before I applied to grad school, I didn't think I was going to be doing political science myself. So I understand that. The nonetheless, so from a Catholic perspective, obviously there is the argument that the communities that you belong to and that you benefit from, you owe those communities, certain obligations, certain duties in return. And in the political sphere, the traditional church teachings have been that, at least when you're under a legitimate government, that you should pay the taxes, that if necessary, you should, be willing to do your part to defend the country. And then within democratic or participatory systems, the church argues that you really have a duty to vote. Although I'd say more fully, it's you have a duty to form your conscience and vote. I mean, I dissent from some people in that I tend to think that if you're genuinely uninformed, then voting in itself is not a virtuous act. Like just the fact that, I have no idea what I just did, but I voted. Like that's not something to celebrate. So I tend to think of it as a two-step duty. You should inform yourself, then you should vote. If you don't bother to inform yourself, then, I'm not sure you really do have an obligation to vote. But for people who aren't excited, I would say, politics is almost always one of those situations where you're trying to choose the lesser evil. That, there's not going to be a perfect option out there. I mean, I think most people know that both of the candidates that we're facing right now have significant flaws. And there are a lot of people out there that wish there was somebody else, but there isn't, right? These are the candidates. This is, it's what is it as, Gandalf says in Lord of the Rings, that we don't get to choose the times we live in. All we get to choose is what we do, in the circumstances we find ourselves in. So it's the same thing with voters. But it makes a difference to choose the lesser evil, right? Even if they're both imperfect, it makes a difference to try to figure out, which one's worse and to try to do what you can to prevent that person from being in charge. So that's not necessarily motivating or inspiring, like, get out there and stop the greater evil. But that really is part of the basis for, I think, for the requirement, or the duty to vote, is that part of serving the common good is if you think this, these people are both bad, but this person's worse, this is something that I can do to contribute to try to get the better option up there, I should do it. I mean, especially because when you think about it, voting costs you almost nothing. I mean, it's like going to the grocery store. I mean, it really doesn't, getting yourself informed, that can cost you something. This is where our schools, I think, need to do a better job, because I don't think, people like in their 30s or 40s shouldn't have to be educating themselves on American civics like from ground zero, right? There should be a foundation built when you're younger. But so that takes work. But the actual voting, it's like, it takes like, I mean, where I live, it's like 15 minutes.
Just get in line.
Exactly.
That's true. Yeah, it doesn't. And it's, yeah, and it's something, yeah. And that's what one of the in the conversation last week too, we talked about, just that idea of being informed. I think that's very important too,
Yes.
and Pope Francis mentioned that too, of like choosing the lesser of two evils and in the midst of all of this, we have, okay, an adult, over age of 18 has the option if they're, ready and informed and can, or if they're not, they can vote as well. How would you encourage parents to kind of start this conversation of kind of the civic duty of voting, but also just in politics in general. I think that, like you said, the education system is struggling in how to explain, you know, how the do they even know that there are three branches of government? Do they even, you know, like how would you go about helping children, parents help their children to kind of better understand this process so that they can be informed when the time comes?
That's a great question because, yeah, again, it depends a little bit on circumstances. Because obviously, like if you're a homeschooler or something like that, and you've got a lot more kind of room to do things. But if you're not, I mean, in this, as in many other things, I tend to think that even before you talk about the kinds of conversations you have with your children, it's important to think about the kinds of conversations your children are going to overhear. And I think when it comes to citizenship, this is one of those areas where it's important that you have a home environment where the children are in a position to overhear you and your spouse talking about these things. Because that's, you know, the pa parents are the first model of all sorts of behavior for kids. One of the things that they are a first model for is for civility, for what it looks like to speak reasonably and even disagree reasonably about political topics. And then as the children get older, so if you just kind of make an effort to actually demonstrate to your kids what it looks like to articulate a judgment you have made about the character of the system, about what should be done. And then as the kids get older, that's when you can start kind of incorporating them into the conversation. And that also provides an opportunity to start to explain some of the how-to. You know, like, okay, well, we're talking about the president, but now here's the system, you know, and so you can go from a civil conversation, a responsible, a prudent conversation about some particular issue, and you can begin to kind of bring in the bigger picture. And that also gives you an opportunity to, you know, assess what your kids have picked up at school. Because, yeah, I mean, I would say at a lot of schools, you know, just based on experience, I mean, I'm teaching a co-op class right now on American government. But for the most part, I teach college students, and I can tell you from personal experience that, you know, when people become naturalized citizens, they have to take an exam, like a civics exam, and I can tell you right now that the vast majority of college freshmen would fail that exam. And they're just coming out of high school, so that means it's likely that the vast majority of adults would also fail that exam, which is unfortunate. The only thing, the only in one the one class where I actually administered it in class, the only question that every single student got right was how long a president serves in office, right? 4 years. Everybody knows that because every 4 years there's this circus. Although now it's more like, you know, you have like 6 months off and then you have a 3.5 year circus. But so, yeah, so just having kind of civil conversations among adults that the children can overhear, inviting them into those over time, using those as occasions for plumbing what they know and expanding what they know is I think the best way to do it. And also to, you know, inculcate in them, in the students, you know, the awareness that civic participation is a moral duty. It's a moral action. You know, your actions are, you know, subject to moral evaluation, that this is an area where you're having to choose between right and wrong or between the better and the worse. But at the same time, that it's one of those areas where it's oftentimes going to be lesser of two evils to try to make just make them aware of, you know, that this it's not it's dignified. It's not simple to be a citizen. But you got to start by modeling it.
Modeling. Perfect. Yes. Do you have any final thoughts to kind of round out the conversation?
No, I mean, it's, you know, this is, it's funny. Sometimes I wonder, you know, because I teach American politics so much, and then you hear about how little civic knowledge people have. And I don't know, does that mean I'm irrelevant or does that mean I'm needed now more than ever? Right? You know, what's the situation? You know, I think it's important for people not to get discouraged about things. But I understand that it's increasingly difficult for them to do so. So I do think that one, you know, kind of one of the best things that you can do, and one of the things that I do is that, you know, politics is not everything, but it is very, very important. But to be a good citizen does not require that you follow everything minutely. You know, before you cast a vote, you should inform yourself about the candidates so that you have a basic sense of it. But beyond that, it's more kind of like, you know, try to feed your soul with the more edifying things, you know, like read about the life of Sir Thomas More, or you know, read the Federalist Papers, or something where where you can kind of touch base with why politics, even though it seems maybe kind of like a grubby and partisan thing on a day-to-day basis, is kind of an important part of the human condition. And it's one of the areas where we can learn to be excellent, where we can display virtue, where we can help one another. But to kind of remind yourself of that really does require that you kind of step back a little bit from the day-to-day and reconnect with first principles. And this was something, I think it was John Adams who first put this in the Massachusetts Constitution, 1780, I think it was. There's a, you know, a frequent recurrence to first principles or to fundamental principles is an important part of maintaining a good citizenry. Step back from the day-to-day and remind yourself about what's most important.
Excellent. Wow, thank you so much, Dr. Cole, for sharing your expertise in this subject matter.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Ferris Love Podcast. In 2024, we want to reach as many people as possible. You can help by sharing this episode with a friend, subscribing to the podcast, or leaving a review. To learn more, visit us at ferrislovshrine.org.